Caro, and welcome to episode 155 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week joined her first band in 1967, and she's only 65 now, so you do the math. Hello, Susan Cowsill. That first band was her family band, the Cowsills, and Susan was the youngest and only female among the singing siblings. She sang lead on the Chiffons' Sweet Talkin' Guy on the Ed Sullivan Show when she was just 8, and her vocal at age 9 on the single Indian Lake made her the youngest female performer to sing on a top 10 hit. On the Cowsills' 1968 smash version of the musical title track Hair, Susan Cowsill made an indelible impression singing two words. Jump to the 1990s, and Susan Cowsill was making a name for herself with another band, the Continental Drifters. She and her friend Vicki Peterson of the Bangles joined this indie supergroup that also included Peter Hulsapple of the DBs and Mark Walton of the Dream Syndicate. Peterson and Hulsapple are previous Caro Pop guests, of course. Aside from being one of the Continental Drifters' lead singers, Cowsill learned to play guitar and began writing songs for the first time. The Rain Song, one of her earliest efforts, kicks off the band's second and most acclaimed album, Vermilion. The Continental Drifters now are the subject of Sean Kelly's new authorized biography, White Noise and Lightning, The Continental Drifters Story, and a tribute album called We Are All Drifters. Peterson married Susan's brother, John Cowsill, making Susan and Vicki sisters-in-law. Susan and Vicki also performed together for many years as the Psycho Sisters before finally releasing an album, Up on the Chair Beatrice, in 2014. Susan Cowsill was married to Hulsapple for 9 years, and they still perform together on occasion, including at an REM-themed concert that Cowsill hosted in her hometown of New Orleans a few days after this conversation took place. Susan also continues performing with her older brothers Bob and Paul as the Cowsills. Susan Cowsill still has that kid sister energy, which makes for a very lively conversation. Did she want to join the family band at such a young age? How did she and her family feel about the Partridge Family, the early 70s sitcom loosely based on the Cowsills? How close did she and her fellow Cowsills actually get to starring in the Partridge Family? And what did she think of that made-for-TV band's music? Susan Cowsill also reflects on her years with singer-songwriter Dwight Twilley, her friendship with Vicki Peterson, and her love of New Orleans despite the devastating impact that Hurricane Katrina had on her family. Her second solo album, 2010's Lighthouse, includes a rousing version of River of Love, written by her brother Barry before he died in the hurricane. She also discusses the re-release of the Cowsills' long-lost 1998 album, Global, out November 8th, as well as the future of the Continental Drifters. Will there be more Drifters shows and another album? She's a wonderful singer and conversationalist. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Susan Cowsill.
Set out on this lonesome ride and I did it on my own, searching for a million years for where do I belong, but always still feel the light.
How long have you been in New Orleans, by the way?
31 years. And it was a 2-year plan. Orleans will do that to a person, they say.
Exactly. What was the two years? Like, what were you planning at that time?
93, 94, get out of there in 96, 95 and head back to Rhode Island. My first husband, that was my... He said if we could go to New Orleans for a couple of years, that he'd take me back where I come from.
Right.
And by the time it was time to go back, I didn't want to go.
So you guys stayed down there. How many different groups of musicians are you playing with these days?
Right now?
Yeah.
I am Cowsills. I'm my solo thing, which I'm getting ready to do a thing here in town on Friday. Look, in the bands I'm in, you're always in them and they take hiatuses.
Right.
Their family, like the Drifters. The Continental Drifters is a family band of non-DNA components. And, we're reunioning. I think when you get older, instead of pressuring yourself to say you have a new band because you just can't even fathom the idea, you just say you're reunioning and it just eases the idea. So we're reunioning.
Do you prefer being in a band or doing your own thing?
Oh, band every time. not interested, just something I need to do to keep the coffers moving. I mean, you know, and I evidently need to write things and say things, obviously, but I don't know. I could just work in a laundry and be perfectly happy, I think.
Huh. Yeah. But the band thing, like being sort of one of like multiple singers or songwriters, yeah, that's more that's your... Fun.
It's fun because, and maybe it's because I've been at this since I was 7, but I am fairly over my story and my expression of things and my phenomenal whatever. And I really enjoy just the musical sharing.
Right.
And it's less stressful. You don't have to be the main guy, like the ringleader 24/7. When you hit a stage and it's your show, you don't get a break. And I like a good break at work.
Well, you know, I talked to your friend Vicki Peterson a few months ago, and she was of that mind as well. I'm like, there's no Vicki solo album, but, you know, she's got the Psycho Sisters with you and the Drifters and the Bangles.
And then the Psychos. I mean, again, they're all family bands that you're never really like out of.
Right. So, but it is like a different mentality, I think, of people who want to be in a band versus people who want to just sort of call the shots and have people supporting them. And, you know,
for sure it is. You're coming from an entirely different artistic energy, and there's nothing wrong with any of them. But, and again, for me, I've got to do every version of it. So I don't have any itches needed scratching or scratches needed itching, but you know what I mean? It's like, I don't need anything. I just want to commune with my people. And there's a handful of people that the way we commune is through music, you know? And so that's what it's about.
Well, and you're basically born into a family band, like already there was no even sort of like, you know, answering an ad or running into someone in high school. No. There was like, it's in my house.
It's in my house. No, in fact, I had to like, you know, I felt like I needed an agent to get me in the band. It was hell. My brothers didn't want me in their band. You don't want your little sister in your band.
You're like, come on, you need me to sing Aunt Spaghetti.
Who could have known? Those poor guys. Can you imagine the horror that day? I was there. I saw the looks on their collective faces.
Was that fun? I mean, like joining the band? I mean, were you just like, hey, I'm the little sister, let me in this band. You need
a girl. Oh my God. Please. Why? Yeah. I mean, and all the other houses in the hood, you know, people come home and go do their homework or go do whatever. My people come home and they get on these instruments and play this music. And I thought that was really cool. And anything they did, I wanted to do. It didn't matter. Football, baseball, walking up to whatever. I just had to be in. Made them nuts. I'm sorry, you guys. I'm going to take out a billboard when it's all over.
Yeah, I was at a used record store and I found Captain Sad and His Ship of Fools, like a really nice copy of it. And I'm like, that's a cool record. And it's fun. And
it's a cool record, isn't it?
It's got Indian Lake on it, which I saw a thing that said that you were the youngest person to be directly involved in a top 10 hit record when Indian Lake made the top 10.
Yep. The Casey Kasem told me on his TV show one morning that I was the youngest female performing artist on a top 10 rock and roll record, and Indian Lake was my in, and that the only other person who held that was Michael Jackson. It was me and Mike.
Wow.
So and I don't think it'll ever happen. I don't think we'll get usurped because all the young people, like, have at least been like 12 or 30, you know, and Mike and I think we were 9.
You got a lead vocal on there, Ask the Children.
Yeah. Another day in the notches of the belts of the boys, where now I get a solo. What a cool song, though, right?
Absolutely.
It's a protest song for kindergartners. I just, you know, I'm thinking of covering it. I've thought about that recently because I like doing protest songs right now, just kind of in the mood.
What was the first song that you ever wrote on your own?
Was a song called Anyway, and it was written for Vicky's fiance who was dying. We lost a Bobby along the way. And then the second song was the Rain Song, crazily enough. I know.
you've been a musician for a long time, because Rain Song being the kickoff song on the brilliant Continental Drifters album Vermilion. So that was you'd been around doing this for a while before you actually got the bug on this.
You know, the funny thing is, Mark, I've been around for since the beginning of time, but I didn't start writing songs or playing an instrument other than that godforsaken tambourine, which I love. But I didn't start writing till I met the Continental Drifters. And Vicky pushed me. She was very pushy. She's a pushy young lady. And she thought it was close to ridiculous that I hadn't learned to play a guitar or write a song yet. So I set about it, and that's what happened. And I think all the years of absorbing my surroundings, from Cowsills to Dwight Twilley, who was an amazing songwriter, and that music really sunk in my head. And I think just once I hit the deck, it all just kind of came out.
Had you attempted to write on your own, or had you really been just like, I'm just
no,
not, it's not
no
my
interest,
thing.
No interest. I am a reluctant musical career person. I love music and I will always sing, but this business stuff. And I think it's just cause like we said, you know, you get started at 7, you know?
Right. Well, it's fun seeing the Drifters get their due now. I mean, we have this, you're in it, you know, the White Noise and Lightning, the Continental Drifter Story by Sean Kelly. Yes. You know, there's a new album of
fantastic,
you know, sort of tribute songs to that. So a lot of ground is covered in this book, but I just want to ask, just for conversation's sake, you joining the Continental Drifters, sort of how did that happen and what was it for you? I've interviewed Peter Hulsapple and Vicky Peterson. And in both of their cases, they were sort of coming off of bands and situations that it was like, this was like this oasis of playing with friends.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if it had any of the same, I mean, you were in a different situation, but did it have any of that same feel?
Yeah. Different, but the same. And it's funny because we just did a Zoom the other night together, all of us, with Sean and Brett Milano. And, you know, the identifier for the Drifters that year anyway seemed to be transition from either a relationship or a band, or a relationship or a band and a band, and or a relationship with a band with a relationship. So there was Vic and I out of said bands and relationships. And we were kind of single ladies contemplating cat ownership way before it became popular this year as a way of life, and just, you know, the heck with it. And then I think what happened, if I'm not mistaken, one of the things that happened, there's a lot of versions, because we knew Mark Walton because we were psychosistering. So we were down at his rehearsal studio. But simultaneously, my brother Barry was working with said Peter Hulsapple, and the Cowsills, the version we were in 1990, was playing. And my brother Barry brought Hulsapple to the show. And I met him that night. Now, I can't remember. Well, so, okay. So, like, I heard it told the other night that we did it through Mark through Earshot. But I think I remember saying to Vicky, they have this band down at Raji's. I met this guy. She knew who he was. I didn't. I'm like, yeah, whatever, R.E.M. And he's like, you're so weird. And I'm like, right. But anyway, they have a band and let's go do something fun. So we went down to Raji's. And the rest is history. We sat and watched these guys, and they were super cute, incredibly talented. And I know if we had just gone and saw them and left, we probably wouldn't be in the band, but we went and saw them and met them. And then they were like, I mean, look, you hang out with Vicky Peterson, the boys are going to notice you. And like, we're Ginger and Marianne. So I was like, oh my God, look what's happening to us tonight. It's like, y'all want to sing on something? And it just kind of went. It just went. And then, you know, Gary and then Peter and then, you know, just, you know how it is, Mark.
Right. Well, it's fascinating because it was a band, because they existed before the three of you joined.
Correct. And I dare say it took itself a little bit of a rinse and repeat, probably much to everybody's surprise a little bit, maybe, because even though I was very foreign to how any other band but the Cowsills worked, truly foreign to how bands worked other than mine. So we come and we meet these guys, and there's these guys, and they're calling themselves the Continental Drifters, and Peter's kind of hanging out, but there's this guy, Danny Magoo, who really is in the band. But then, like, the next thing you know, he's not, and Peter is, and then the next thing I knew, me and Vic were in the band, and Carlo just announced it at a rehearsal one afternoon. Literally, we weren't in the band. We were just going to sing with them on these things at somewhere. And then after that rehearsal, Carlo goes, well, all right, we're going to meet tomorrow, and I'll be back here at noon, and all right, I guess the girls are in the band now. All right, everybody, see you. And Vic and I looked across the room and went, what the fuck just happened? I mean, she looked at me like, what was? And like, everybody just kind of said goodbye, and we got in the car and went, did you? And I said to her, did you say something? And she's like, no, did you? And I'm like, no. And so we just, and then of course, neither one of us refuted it. I guess, I don't know. It was 40 years ago.
Did you two want to be in a band at that point?
I don't think I knew any other way. Let me see. No, I had just done my 10 years with Dwight. So I did know another way. Yeah, but I think I wanted to be in a band just to be rebellious against Dwight, who didn't want me in a band. I want to just get married and have a million kids and call it a day. But nobody would let me do that.
And you and Vicky were just friends already.
Friends. And then, yeah, we met. I'm sure she told you, or maybe she did. We met back in the 70s when there wasn't a Bangles. They were the Bangs, and they were all still in school and just figuring out who they were. And the Cowsills, again, were playing around L.A. And they came around as high school ladies to our Cowsill shows. And I knew what was up. They're all gaga goo Cowsill girl fans. I know them a mile away.
Nice.
And the fact that they were a budding band and wanted to study harmonies and all this crap they were throwing down, I wasn't buying it. And I think they just wanted to hang out with the Cowsill boys because they were darn cute. I love that Vic's not here to like smack me and say counter things.
Oh, good.
And what consequently happened was I quit the band that year and I kind of went underground. And about 5 years later, I was watching maybe 3 years later, I was watching MTV and I saw Manic Monday. And I called my brother. I go, dude, I just was watching MTV. You remember those girls who used to come to earshot? He goes, yeah, Susan. They have a hit record. They're called the Bangles. I'm like, when did that happen? He was like, you've been under your rock. It's kind of new, but not. He stayed in touch with Vicky. She used to send him Christmas cards. And so the day I broke up with Dwight, I went down to my brother's pub because I was going to sing again. And Vic walked in and we'd been best friends ever since.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Reluctant best friend. She thought I should be in school and I thought she needed to go mind her own business somewhere else when we first met. And I let her know it.
In the Drifters, it's interesting because you seem to be, you know, from album to album, like, I don't know if the word leadership is right, but you're definitely kind of front and center on those records. And
leadership is not right.
Okay. Tell me about like sort of how you developed as a singer and also just kind of your confidence level, just being in the Drifters.
How I did it was being in the Drifters. There is nothing more validating. You can go to school or you can hang out with, I mean, I'll be honest, Gary Eaton was one of the primary first guys going, this is so stupid that you don't know how to play. I just don't believe it. And he handed me a guitar and he's like, put your fingers here. I mean, you know, and I just started doing it, you know, and I wanted to write. Vicky thought I could. And I just was okay at it. And they liked it. And they would say I was good. And they put me where they put me. What I loved about the Drifters was my anonymity when it wasn't my turn. It's what I love about the Drift. It's what I love about the Cowsills. Mm. You just have a moment. You have your position, but you're not the focal point. And I find that as much as I love entertaining, I find that overwhelming sometimes to know that if I'm not either funny or sound good or look good every minute for the next 90, you know, it's like somebody do something or say something to these people and give me 5 seconds. So I like being in a band.
What did you think of the songs that, you know, everyone else was bringing in?
I couldn't believe how instant, like we would have these, like if somebody wrote a song we'd have rehearsal, you know, and then you'd sit in the living room and just, they never weren't amazing. I don't recall one song never not making it to the place. And I, again, because I only knew what I knew, now I think this is how it happens everywhere too, you know, and that's what real bands do. But it is the band, the ego, you know, like groups of people, they get together and have a chemistry that is undeniable for universal and spiritual reasons. It's cool.
Did you start off with your writing? Were you also co-writing with Vicky and Peter? I mean, there are some co-writing credits on those.
Yeah,
records.
No. Well, Vic and I, yes. Yes. Vicky, God, yes. Peter, no. Peter, I co-wrote Drifters with.
Right. Which is a big one.
Yep. And we wrote it separately together, though. And here's why. Because I started writing. Vicky is the very first person to say, I must write. The Continental Drifters, literally, it was all kind of in the same year or two. But she was the one. She was the main one and told me, just put, you know, whatever you're thinking, put it on a cassette tape. You know, when Peter and I got together, he wanted to co-write with me, but I was scared because I'd only ever written with Vicky. And I liked it. I'm a very creature of habit. And I'm also very I don't have a lot of confidence in certain areas that might be surprising to some. And songwriting is one of them, where if I'm alone, I'm okay, because it's just me and I'm fixing and judging and doing whatever. But if I'm with somebody else, it kind of feels weird, unless it's their song. As I've grown, I can help you with yours, but like mine's too personal and weird. Like, get out of my head and room. And that's how it feels. So no, no big co-writes with Holsapple. I think it was very sad for him. So we'll
and at some point, you guys—I mean, you guys were married at some point. So,
oh yeah, we were married for 9 years.
Yeah.
Look, Mr. Holsapple had an amazing run. We have an amazing daughter, and we are the very best of friends. Russ and he are besties. We're all grown ups. We've been on this planet forever, and we all know how life happens. And when you're in it, and you're learning it, it's different. Once if you've learned it and you review it, if you don't have an overview that makes some kind of learning curve sense to you and you lean into it, then I guess, I don't know, too bad for right. you.
But to go back to the co-writing thing, like the whole band dynamic is also like, if the person wants to co-write you also happens to be married to you, that's like different than, you know, some random person who's like, hey, let's write songs together. Like, nah,
yeah.
Okay.
And it's funny because I have like, I think it's like I have issues. Like the first time I'm going to do it with Vicky, and then that's going to be that. Then the only other person that I'm very comfortable writing with is my husband, Russ. And we co-wrote a ton of my solo stuff. So I think I have to be really, really comfy. And Holsey and I, we were like a couple. I just felt like he was my husband and we had a baby and like I don't know. He's Peter Holsapple, for God's sake. He's the king of songwriting. It was intimidating. Intimidation.
Would he come to you and say, look, I've written this song for you to sing on this record. Like, yeah. I want to learn to waltz with you is one
yeah,
that he wrote.
Love that. That was fun to have happen. That was the best part of that, is singing all his demos. He was trying to get it maybe covered by somebody else. Dwight did that a lot too. I enjoyed doing that. Great songs. I get to sing them. I have no responsibility to them. I don't have to make them hits, but I get the fun. Yeah.
Do you generally have a preference between singing your own songs or singing someone else's songs?
I think I like to sing other people's songs better as a singer, because I think I don't write for my voice. So they're not necessarily showcasing my voice, perhaps. I don't know. I probably don't know what I'm talking about because I'm talking about me. Well, I don't know, man.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Like, you have a wonderful version of Who Knows Where the Time Goes,
yeah.
which is a Sandy Denny song from Fairport Convention. And you guys have done a whole Fairport, you know, covers record, which that's not on. This is on your first solo record.
Yeah.
But, the, you know, between Sandy Denny and Judy Collins, you know, that song has two pretty indelible performances, and yet you really make that thing your own. It's pretty great, and it's not like a carbon copy of either of the other two. So that takes some, you know, like...
So that's what I like to do the best, is take a favorite song and then pretend I'm that, you know. It's like, I mean, just really honestly, it's like karaoke. You know, it's a favorite song you love, and you love the way that person sings it. So you're going to try and feel, you're going to try and sing the way that made you feel. And that's a real joy as a singer. And I realize that I have been gifted. It's like having a amusement park ride in your body. Mm-hmm.
What kind of ride? Which ride is it?
Oh, it's like a really smooth, incredible roller coaster. And then sometimes it gets a little janky, but yeah.
Was there some point where you sort of said to yourself, wait a minute, I'm a singer. That's what I do.
Right.
Did you always feel that? I was going to say, because you, again, you're in the family band.
Right from the beginning. I watched myself on Ed Sullivan, and I'm doing we did a medley on Ed Sullivan on one of our, and everybody took a piece of a song, of a hit song of the day. And I did Sweet Talking Guy. And I was just eight. I was tiny. I don't even know when I look at her, but I am just wailing on this song because I knew I was killing it and it was good. And I hear it now and it's great. I hear myself with Dean Martin and I go, I don't even understand how I'm doing it, but it's something I know how to do, and it saves my soul at the same time, which I think it was created to do that.
Nice.
Yeah. Pretty. And it's free. It's wearing its ass out, but.
was there anyone who you kind of looked up to as a singer, like in terms of like trying, I want to sing like that, or was it really just kind of coming out the way it came out?
It was all of it. It as a singer, it was definitely Ronstadt. But it was also Leslie Gore, and it was also Mary Travers, and it was also Judy Call. You know, I mean, Mama Cass. It was also Spanky from, you know, all the everything I heard from the minute I got here. I just thought it was magic. Just music on a radio is like it was magic. And then you swallow it in your body and now you have it and you feel better. and then they turn it into what we do. And it really came in handy because evidently we needed to, those Calso kids needed to, they needed that. So I think it was divine intervention, all of our talent.
Nice.
Yeah.
There's something about family members when they sing together, that there's something in the way their voices blend, even though it's like, you know, you and brothers, there's something about the way families sound together that is just different from random other people.
It's even like now, like there's almost like a science study about it, and it appears to be some kind of resonance. The similarities of the vocal cords in a DNA fashion have whatever that thing is that we hear in the Beach Boys, the Bangles, the Cowsills, the Bee Gees, you know, and that some others can capture. Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, Susan and Vicky, John and Paul, you know, the Beatles. And, you know, there are people who can make it happen. But the nature thing, the DNA thing is a thing. And here's what they say occurs. So when a DNA and a DNA voice sing together, that there is a resonance that creates almost a third sound by the collaboration of their two, like some energy, like wavelength energy echo. So if three Calsos sing, it sounds like six.
Wow.
If two Calsos, it sounds like four. And it's like a weird, and I think I'm completely inept at describing the scientific moment.
No, this is great. No, you're doing great.
But it is a thing, and they say it's a thing. So, yeah, that.
And do you still, I mean, it's funny because, again, you sang with siblings, brothers, when you were very young. You're still doing it now. Does it, like, what's the carryover? Does it feel like a similar, you know, experience, even though
obviously you've been doing
this for a long time?
It's the same moment, and we're way better than we used to be. So it's like riding a ride. I mean, sometimes In fact, like at the end of, okay, so we're on this tour every year for 10 years, gold watches, everything. And it's the Happy Together tour. And at the end, we do a finale. And we collectively as Cows Hills and really in the Drifters too, we don't want to sing on the same mic. It's just, no, I don't care about how cool it looks and how, who did when. But at the end of the Happy Together thing, we do the finale and Paul and I are on the same mic. And we just do the chorus, I love the flower girl. And we sing our harmony like right there. And, but like this summer we were tripping because he was like, do you hear us? It's like this machine gets poked and this sound, because we're so close to each other. We're like, it even blew us away.
Right.
Yeah.
Does the making music together bring you together as a family as well?
Of course it does. Yes. And maybe more in our case, because we were little kids and it was a form of play, and it still is. It's how we be together. And it's not like we can't go out to dinner and we can't do Christmas, but this is how we were born together to have fun. So if we're up on stage and we're every night we play, we're idiots up there just being goofy because we're on stage and it never stops. And it's, I just can't get over it sometimes. I'll get smacked in the arm, like, you know, like we're just at the table sometimes for what I said, and then have to step up and sing and not punch his ass out. You know, I mean, it's hilarious.
That's very funny. Well, look, there are plenty of examples of families and bands where they do not get along as well as you guys. So
yeah, no, it's a miracle. But we always, I think we raised each other. I think we're each other's parents, brothers, sister, mothers, fathers, the whole thing. So it's different maybe for us. I don't know.
Do you have the dynamic where like you'll have friends who are like older or younger, but you're always kind of in the same birth order with your own family? Like you're always the little sister as opposed to just the sister.
Are you kidding? I am 5 years away from 70. And my brother Bob will still say to my brother Paul when I'm trying desperately to interrupt, do you hear something? Is there a mosquito in this room? Like, because while we're talking, I'm hearing this thing just fly by and it keeps coming by and coming. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah. It keeps you young.
Yes. The answer is yes.
See, they keep you young because you feel they're treating you like you're 9 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. They do. They're punks. That's my, yeah. Yeah.
Well, and then Vicky's your sister-in-law. So maybe that's why you guys sound so good together.
Yeah. Well,
or the other way around.
When she told me she was marrying John, I told John that indeed she was marrying him, but it was entirely just to be legally become my sister. I don't know what he was thinking. Anything else had anything to do with it.
Right.
But whatever there.
Your psycho sister.
The psycho sisters. Oh, yeah.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great beers include the classic Anti-Hero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. Now you can get the DDH Colada Hero, a hazy double IPA laden with a classic swizzle of coconut and pineapple notes. DDH Colada Hero is lush and tropical, offering waves of sweet piña colada bliss. Crack a can and let the rush of island vibrancy whisk you away.
Says that each of us here is allowed just one friend and just one friend alone. That's what best friends are for.
Well, here's the problem with the Psycho Sisters doing another record. We wrote those records. I think at the time we recorded them, we realized they had been written 23 years prior. You know, so break up, like our boy song, like our breakup and dead boy songs and We Hate Our Lives and, you know, all that fun, stupid stuff that by the time we were recording it, we were well over. And so on a timeline, I mean, then that came out, God, probably 10 years ago now. And so if we were to start writing, I just don't think either one of us lifespan would support another release. I'm just not sure.
What you mean? Because you'd have to write it and then wait 20 years to put it out?
Well, how it went last time. I mean, if we go along the same timeline and then there's a 23-year lull, I think the kids are going to have to put it out.
Well, give you guys an excuse to write together and sing together.
Oh, because like I need an excuse to do one more thing.
Right. Because like, as I started at the beginning.
Out, how many bands am I in? Someday, well, no, musicians don't retire. But someday I'd like to act out retirement at least 2 days a week.
So that's, if you'd move back to Rhode Island instead of being in New Orleans where everyone's a musician and there's music all the time.
There's that. But I know I get away with murder here in New Orleans as a musician who plays little, but that's just because I've been busy with the cow stills. So, you know, it's all good. I love it all. And I'm so grateful for every inch of it. I'm just being me.
Do you guys do an REM? It's like your classic albums.
So yeah, In the City.
Covered in Vinyl series.
Yeah, the Covered in Vinyl series that Russ and I started back at the Carrollton Station in the early 2000s. And we've done over 150 records. And we are doing REM on Friday. But I begged out. It's because it's our series. We can create how it goes anytime we want. I can make the rules up as I go. So the rules this month, so we aren't doing a classic album. We're doing selections from the four main voted best REM records. And Mr. Holzapfel is coming in because he was a no-brainer. You know, how do we get all those guitars taken care of without even trying? Hey, Holz! And vocals.
What were the four albums?
Automatic. Look, I don't know a lot of REM. I only knew their hits. Even 9 years married to Mr. Holzapfel. So I had to learn a lot of songs. We're doing 18. But Automatic for the People, and then Out of Time, and then I'm looking at the covers. I don't know them. Two other ones that they were the most popular. We went online, we voted. People were having,
Murmur?
You know, burning down buildings over what songs should be done.
Interesting.
Could get very, you know, I don't know what's going to happen at the show because people were up in arms.
So, and then Cow Stills also, you guys announced a new old release today, this album Global, which I think it was released in 98, recorded in 93, coming out in vinyl in 2024.
And everything old is new again.
I I'm not saying this to sort of, you know, have fun with anyone who writes the press materials, but it's like the Castles have announced the release of Global, a recovered album from the chart-topping family band whose story was the inspiration for television's The Partridge Family. And as someone who's old enough to remember The Partridge Family, I get it, but it kind of struck me as funny in 2024 to being like, you know why you want to get this 1998 album from this band?
Because of The Partridge Family.
They inspired The Partridge Family in 1970.
I think these are very desperate times, Mark, because invariably you work. And God bless Omni. I love everyone and everything. That's just a blanket. But you make these albums, you know, and then they work on the covers and they do everything and everything's and all this artwork. And then they smack these stickers on them and they are never not what you just described. And so I look, there might be some 72-year-old dude walking down going, and he can't even see, but he sees the words Partridge Family and he goes for it. I don't know.
Well, it is part of, you know, the story. And I'm not making fun of them. And Omnivore does great stuff. I mean, I've bought
a lot
of their records. And so,
I mean, they got to jostle the memory, dude.
it sort of shows whose memories they're going after.
Because
I was in the.
But boomers are happening. Boomers are the ones still going to concerts. They're still buying material that they could download, mostly because they don't know how, but they also think it's rude.
Were you guys watching The Partridge Family at the time and going, oh, this is like supposed to be us?
Well, we knew it was us because they came out to our house to try and cast us. It was our show. That was a show brought to us by Screen Gems. My dad screwed it up and we didn't want it. It was too much going on and they wanted Shirley Jones to play the mom no matter what, a known actress, and that wasn't going to work. So we turned it
down. That would have been so weird.
And they wanted me and Barry. At the end of the day, when Dad was like, we're not doing it, they were like, well, can we at least have two of the kids? And Dad was no. And that was that. We went to the premiere of it. They had a showing for us and a little party. We sat there going, I mean, I'm watching a young lady who cannot even connect her palm of her hand to the tambourine when she's playing it. And she's just like going like, and like, it, again, I will refer you to Ed Sullivan, at which point I'm playing tambourine on Reach Out, like I was born with it. And like I'm a small black child wailing on this tambourine. And now they have this little redheaded girl who's staring off into the distance, missing her palm. So that's how The Partridge Family was for us kids. Then we found out they killed off our father in the script, and that's how Reuben can kill. And this is a true story, and I heard it watching a documentary on the Partridge Family. Schwartz, the guys who write it, Sherwood, and you know those two dudes, they said that they wrote the Cowsills dad out because he was such a pain in the ass. So they killed him off for fun. Well, let's kill the husband. All right, he's dead. She's a widow. Bring in Kincaid.
So Reuben owes his existence to them being irritated with negotiating with
my dad for being impossible.
That's very funny.
I thought it was a pretty cool piece of history, really. Honest to God, I thought that is badass.
Wow. So yeah. You guys wouldn't like gather around the TV on...
I watched it. I wanted to... Yeah, it was a... I watched The Partridge Family. I had a crush on David Cassidy, which created very confusing feelings for me. Because I knew he was supposed to be one of my older brothers.
Right.
And I even said, he's so cute. And I feel... Mom, she's like, Susan, he's an actress. This isn't real. What have I done? And when my mom passed away, and this is also the God honest truth, I had a dream, a very vivid dream, that Shirley Jones adopted me. She called me.
Wow.
She knew my mother had died, and I accepted, and she became my mom. I told her that when we had done a benefit for my brother Bill in the 2000s, and she hosted it for us so we could raise money. Billy was sick. And I told her that day, I always wanted to tell her I wanted her. And she went, well, I would have adopted you if you had called me.
Oh,
nice. Wow. Lady. Super amazing woman, Shirley Jones. Her kids are really lucky. They love her dearly. And she's a really wonderful chick.
Well, that's nice. Mm-hmm. I'm glad. No Reuben involved in any of this.
No, I knew Danny I had to meet as a punk by Maureen McCormick one afternoon. She was just trying to torture her friend Bonaducci by presenting a Cowsill in front of him at the time. So I was a pawn for that moment. And then Jeremy Gelblock, who is the original drummer, the brown haired, the brunette drummer. He lives in New Orleans, Louisiana, and he's one of my besties. He's my little bro from another show.
Nice. What did you think of the music at the time? Because they were putting out all of those records, and I think
I thought it was just shitty Cowsill music. And it was produced by Wes Farrell, who had been our last producer. It was just knockoff crap. I knew it, but I loved it. Traveling Along is a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. It was messed up. I mean, you know, you're a little kid, and I'm glad I had it sorted. That this was real, this wasn't, that's not me, but it would have been, but it isn't, but they're acting like it, and somebody else is getting paid, and it's all just crazy.
Was there any resentment that you didn't get to be one of the little kids?
No. I just wanted to get out of my house, and I was on a trajectory path that didn't have those TV shows involved in it. I could go back and get one once I got, you know, up and running as an individual.
Were you still in Rhode Island at the time, by the way?
We're in L.A.
Okay.
We are living in Brentwood.
Yeah, I was picturing you in L.A., but then I was thinking, I don't really know so obviously
we went from Rhode Island to Manhattan to L.A. and then never left until I left, personally.
Got it. So when a new album or new older album like Global is being like re-released, like what's your role in that? Like, is that a good thing? Like, is that a record?
Oh, yeah, that's liking? Great. That's great. I mean, it's like... you know, the reissue world has been familiar to me for a long time because of Cheryl and the gang at Omnivore and the Drifters. We've been knowing Omnivore for a while. And I think is a wonderful end result of efforts made when we were younger, trying to convince the world that just because we were the Cowsills didn't mean you should ignore us. But they did all those years, but we kept plugging away. And so you'll hear... Everyone will hear what we were plugging away at. The thing of it is we weren't a gimmick. We're musicians. We were born musicians. And all we really know how to do is that brings our chi to us is music. So we always did it. And Global. And you know, like, so time wise, we're trying to do what, you know, fit in, be whatever. We don't know who we are. We're just kids the whole time. So, I mean, there's some songs on there that are wacky. There's some new wave. There's some, not disco, but I don't know, man. It's crazy.
Well, they released a song, What I Believe, and there's a lyric video, so I listened to that. It was a good song, just good harmonies, good pop song.
My brother Bob can write. He is one of the finest pop songwriters of his time. And What I Believe, is it any wonder? I mean, there's some just gorgeous. Yeah, I think we're good every time we do what we do, because we're just, I mean, I enjoy hearing it anyway. I would rather say that. I don't know. Good is subjective. I like it and makes me feel good. And so I'm proud of it. If you don't like it, turn it the fuck off. Just saying.
There's plenty of other bad music you could listen to.
Yeah, you can lift the needle because you have vinyl because you're cool now. So lift it off. Skip it.
So what's ahead? Like in all of these different bands and projects and stuff, like what do you?
I just feel like I'm about to immerse into a round robin of Cowsill Broussard, Cowsill's Drifter. And then Vic, I see her on the merry-go-round going, psychos, psychos, psychos.
So are you going to record with anyone, or is this just a matter of appearing live with various people?
I feel the Drifters will make one more. I feel that.
Oh,
there's
nice.
No schedule. There's no talk. There's no songs. Oh, that's not true. But I know it.
Songs. You've written songs for it.
Yeah, I know this. This is what I know. And Cowsills, I think we're going to make a Christmas album. I feel that'll happen. Cowsills will play till they cannot get on that stage anymore. And I have a feeling that I'm scheduled somewhere for another solo record. I know that has to happen just because it just seems to be a thing to do. So I don't think... I'd like to go camping. I would like to get back to Ireland. Mm. I would like to do some gardening, but I sure don't want to not play music too. So I think I'm living the dream and I just don't know it. I'm too old to know it. No. I'm living the dream I wanted to be living 20 years ago.
So have you been writing songs and going, okay, this is a Drifter song. This is a solo song.
Yeah, you can't not. I mean, when you're like you are. So Russ and I, me, him, collective, separate. Like, I write all the time and I just put lyrics. How usually we get a solo record or anything of that nature is that some 5-year moment will happen and a big pile of papers are there that need music to go with them. And then we really just sit down and do it. It just somehow happens like that. And within that pile of life is Cowsill songs, Drifter songs, and me songs. You know, and I know which ones are which.
How?
Because they write themselves. Like if something's too dirgy and something's too much sounding like I listen to way too much James Taylor, it's a Drifter song. If something's poppy and overly jangly, that's a Cowsill moment. It could be a me moment, but if it's too pleasant, I probably won't lean into it. Because if my things jangle with lyrics that don't match generally. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of writing always going on. I don't want others to hear me say that because so I am a kind of writer, not like my friends, like Peter Holzapfel. The man I can't even describe what kind of a songwriter he is. Vicki Peterson. These are professional songwriters and they're people who are born to write songs. And if they don't write them, they don't feel right. They just don't feel like themselves. If they're not doing this thing they were born to do, they don't feel right. And I'm not that person. If I can't bake a cake or make somebody dinner or get a house cleaned, like then I'm not me. Okay. Like the music thing is it's like I have brown hair, black eyes and music. It is like what I am. And it serves a purpose for me that I'm aware of. That has zero zip zilch to do with anybody else and or a career or music or an industry or money or anything.
There's no purpose to it except that it exists because you make music because that's what you do.
Yeah. And without it, I probably wouldn't even be here like as a human because it's what it's I don't want to say weird things, but it's my God. It's my religion. It's my spirituality. It's what I understand was given. I know it's all of it. Right. But the way mine looks is music. And I get that. So you can't be rude to that, even if it's not my first nature. It most definitely is my second, and it's a gift. And how it affects others matters to me, in that I want to be sure to be a good steward of that also. Nice. So that matters too. So I'll be doing this till I croak.
You don't want to squander the gift.
No, I don't. It's precious to me.
And when you write, do you write on paper? Do you go lyrics first? Is that how it
goes? I write on paper, and I'm usually thinking of something. I tried to say 5,000 years ago, and it came out 5 years of sorrows ago, and I loved it.
Mm.
And it's like, oh. And so I write that down, and it's attached to something else that said, I need to find myself a new power. And so sometimes you write a bunch of little things down all in a row, and you look at it and go, well, how the hell did that go together? But it did. It's kind of like that. Music, I'm going to honestly say music comes second for me, and I almost don't think I could have answered that until right this second. So you might be the first guy who got that actual answer.
Hey.
Russ is really good at listening to what I've written with lyrics and getting on a guitar, even though he's the drummer, and making something different happen than I would make happen. And that has been really a cool element of my solo, quote unquote, stuff. Because nothing's solo. That's a bunch of bullshit anyway. There is no solo career, because even if you have a solo, Beyonce has a freaking band and they matter.
Right.
And she can't be Beyonce out there without them, or in the studio or anywhere else. So I'm a big whatever with the solo career thing.
And when you and Russ are working on the music, are you ever like, nah, that doesn't sound right for the song? Or are you really simpatico?
Sure. And because he is a drummer, he'll bring a groove that I won't. I'm fetal rock. My shit, you know, you got to be all curled up in a ball going back and forth.
Rock.
Or some manic. Yeah, that's what I call my drummer.
I like that.
Music is fetal rock, because I'm in a fetal position writing it. But my little other stuff is like running like Ever Ready Buddy, like escape pop rock, you know, run as fast as you can. And tell everybody what's happening really quick on your way out the door.
And are the Drifters going to do shows?
Of course they are.
I mean, are you touring? You're going to come to Chicago?
This is what I'm not using that word tour, and I'm not using back together. I like to say reunion. And so we will say a reunion run. But yeah, of course we're going to play. I mean, it's just things are season. They're seasonal.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. Really appreciate
it. You're welcome. Thank you, Mark.
That's it for episode 155 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Susan Kausel for opening up about her lively lifetime in music. Dig into the Continental Drifters Renaissance with Sean Kelly's new biography, White Noise and Lightning, The Continental Drifters Story, Omnivore Recording's similarly titled Best Of album, plus a tribute album, We Are All Drifters. To order these and to learn more, go to continentaldrifters.com. Omnivore also is releasing a restored remastered version of the Kausels' pure pop long-lost 1998 album Global on November 8th on vinyl, CD, and digital formats. Go to Susan Kausel's Bandcamp page for all of her solo music and follow her on Facebook. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who makes sure these episodes are bangled, tangled, spangled, and spaghettied. If you've gotten this far, you must like Carol Pop, right? Any chance you can support us? For a mere $24, you can become a Carol Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolpop.com. We appreciate you all. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll, at MarkCarro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.